Let me bring on Peter Klein right now. Peter is the Karl Menger Research Fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Mises.org is the indispensable website, M-I-S-E-S.org. He's also Associate Professor in the Division of Applied Social Sciences at the University of Missouri and the Director at the McQuinn Center for Entrepreneurial Leadership. He's also an Adjunct Professor at the Norwegian School of Economics and Business Administration. He's the author of 5 books, including The Capitalist and The Entrepreneur. And he holds a PhD in economics from the University of California at Berkeley. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the program Peter Klein. Peter, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
All right, so I just told everybody about this crazy article in Rolling Stone. I wouldn't have known about it if somebody hadn't tweeted it to me. So the importance of Twitter can't be understated. I sometimes neglect Twitter. I'm on Twitter at Thomas E. Woods. Are you guys just at Mises? Is that your Twitter thing? Or
right, we're at Mises, and I also am on Twitter at Peter G. Klein, K-L-E-I-N.
All right, there you go. So follow all three of us. After this program. That's the key thing. What I want to do is I want to go through, point by point, these 5 surprising ways that Karl Marx predicted 2014. And, you know, articles like this, Peter, they're always written by insufferable jerks who want to say, you know, all you stupid peons think communism was a big failure. But that just shows you didn't understand it, man, you know, because Marx had – he was like a smart guy, and he had a lot of great insights, and I'm going to share them with you stupid rubes.
So, yeah, you know, the continuing fascination with characters like Marx along with John Maynard Keynes is, you know, itself a topic for another one of your shows. I mean, Marx could have easily just sort of slid into the dustbin of history, to use a Marxist phrase, but people continue to read his work even though it's just ponderous, tangentious, not particularly insightful. There's really not a whole lot of value in reading Marx, but people continue to do it, I think, because they like the conclusions that he reaches.
And I don't know. I probably will have to have a program at some point on Marx more generally, just because I'm tired of people who tell me, look, he was a great social scientist, and if you don't see that, then you haven't been reading him. But, I mean, talk about a guy whose system is just based on one fallacy and disprovable statement after another that his own followers have to remake it to make it even remotely plausible.
Right. Well, one thing that's interesting about this article is at the end the author sort of recognizes that Marx is often misinterpreted as someone who, you know, developed a complete, coherent theory of socialism. As the author recognizes, and of course, as Ludwig von Mises pointed out, Marx said very little about socialism, and what he said is demonstrably false, both sort of on logical terms as Mises approached it, and in his on historical terms. But this author continues to make the argument that you often hear, that while Marx may have been incomplete or even wrong on socialism, he was a very perceptive analyst and thoughtful critic of capitalism. But I think Marx was neither of those.
Well, let's start with point number one, the Great Recession, parentheses, capitalism's chaotic nature. So, of course, embedded in this already is a faulty assumption that part of capitalism is having central banks that do so. All right, here we go. I'm just going to read it. I'm going to read it,
okay.
And then we're going to talk about it.
Okay,
so we read this. The inherently chaotic, crisis-prone nature of capitalism, question begging, I inserted that, was a key part of Marx's writings. He argued that the relentless drive for profits would lead companies to mechanize their workplaces, producing more and more goods while squeezing workers' wages until they could no longer produce the products they created. Now, I don't know, should we stop there? Because there's so much there I don't want to forget about. Let's stop there.
I mean, we can, sure. I mean, let me say on this article in general, and I guess you've provided the URL if people want to check it out, you know, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry at the whole thing, because what the author gives us is a mixture of, you know, sort of very general statements from Marx that could be used to apply to almost anything, that aren't very specific, that aren't predictive at all, and, you know, specific remarks of Marx that don't have anything to do with current reality. I mean, let's put it this way, you know, Marx did not offer any comprehensive theory of economic crises. That Marx did not have a business cycle theory that was laid out in very specific detail. And certainly there's nothing at all in Marx's system that in any way you know, corresponds to the kind of business cycle that we're currently going through. You know, a statement like the one you just read, you know, that capitalism is inherently prone to crisis. Okay, fine. I mean, one could say that, and one might say, even an Austrian economist might say, that if by capitalism you mean our current state capitalism with central banking and cronyism and so forth, yeah, that is inherently unstable and is inherently crisis-prone. Ludwig von Mises would not disagree at all with a statement if that's what you meant by capitalism. So to claim from something like that, that Marx has sort of unique insight into, you know, into the financial crisis and the ongoing recession is just sort of nonsensical.
Well, let's look at this. The second sentence is that the relentless drive for profits would lead companies to mechanize their workplaces, producing more and more goods while squeezing workers' wages until they could no longer purchase the products they created. Now, okay, now you are a scholar of entrepreneurship. Isn't it the role of the entrepreneur to anticipate the level of consumer demand? And part of that anticipation is how much people can afford to buy. Like, isn't it the job of the entrepreneur to prevent that outcome?
Oh, of course. I mean, what entrepreneurs are doing, of course, in their relentless pursuit of profits is to try to produce the goods and services that consumers most value. And, of course, entrepreneurs want to pay the inputs into production as little as possible, right? They prefer to pay less to workers rather than more. But competition among entrepreneurs for the services of workers assures that wages will be, you know, driven up to what, you know, the Austrians call their marginal value products. In other words, labor, just like any other resource, gets paid according to its marginal contribution to production. You know, Marx's whole idea was that there was this systematic long-term trend for real wages to fall as more and more of what he called the surplus value for production is extracted or exploited by the capitalists. I mean, that's completely the reverse of the historical experience, as you well know, in that real wages over the last two centuries have continued to rise in terms of what you can buy, the goods and services that one can buy with the money wages that are earned. So, you know, as a long-term, you know, sort of secular trend, this doesn't bear any relation to what we've seen at all.
In fact, Rolling Stone seems not to realize that one of the controversies among Marxist scholars has been how to reconcile this problem, this statement by Marx, this type of statement, with the obvious historical reality that the proletariat has not become immiserated but has improved. So some of them have had to claim that what Marx meant was simply relative impoverishment, that they would actually get better off, but they wouldn't get better off as quickly as others. No. And this guy is just repeating the raw Marxist statement as if this debate hasn't even occurred.
Yeah, you raise a very good general point. I mean, of course, it's fun to talk about a Rolling Stone article, and, you know, a lot more people will probably read this than would read some obscure academic article on Marx. But, I mean, it's as if the author is completely unaware of what's going on in contemporary Marxian scholarship. I mean, there are quite a few academic Marxists still around, and none of them would sort of cut and paste from a Marx's words sort of out of context in this way. Contemporary Marxism is all about reinterpreting Marx, as if he really meant things, as if what he meant was very different from what he actually wrote, to solve the problem that you just brought up, that everything that Marx, you know, predicted about how capitalism would work, I mean, none of it corresponds at all with what capitalism actually does and what the historical experience has been, which is why, just as an aside, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but most of the interest in Marx's thought nowadays is not really among economists or historians, right, but, you know, critical legal theorists and among literary scholars and so forth who believe there's a kind of a cultural Marxism or a philosophic Marxism that may be useful for interpreting different social and cultural trends. But there's hardly any economist or economic historian who takes Marx very seriously anymore.
Well, when you read Marx, he actually suggests, and Rothbard focuses on this quite a bit, that it's as if the capitalist almost doesn't have a properly formed rational faculty, because Marx will claim that it's a mania to accumulate more and more capital. Why? For the sake of accumulation. Just keep accumulating. Keep producing. Yeah. But why would we assume they have no brain? I mean, let's assume though for a moment that they did have no brain, and all they did was just reflexively produce more and more and more and more and more and more and more, way beyond the point at which anybody would want a particular good. So you've got a glut of a particular good, and you don't have a whole lot of use for 800 million widgets. So what is the market response? What do you do then with your 800 million widgets to make sure they clear the market?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Marx really doesn't have any kind of theory of markets. There's nothing, there's no microeconomics, no sophisticated microeconomics in Marx, as you point out. His capitalists, but for that matter, his workers too, his managers. I mean, all of the actors in Marx's system are modeled as just sort of part of a homogeneous class, acting in a mindless way according to class interest. There's not really any theory of individual choice. There's no sort of, you know, rational or purposeful behavior. There's no understanding in Marx of the interconnectedness among different markets. And Marx's analysis, it's almost a little bit pre-Keynesian in the sense that it focuses on these broad aggregates and proposes mechanisms among these aggregate categories of workers and resources and so on, without any kind of understanding of the sophisticated interrelationships among markets, among different types of economic actors, among different resource classes and so forth. So, I mean, it's kind of a sophomoric, cartoonish understanding of what an economy is like. Now, you know, in Marx's defense, or what Marx's defenders have said is, yeah, but Marx wasn't really an economist in that sense. In the sense that we think of the Austrian school or even a Chicago-style economist, that wasn't what Marx was all about. He was doing sort of grand, sweeping social theorizing that doesn't have any, you know, rigorous foundations in actual human behavior.
All right, let's return to Joe, just still in point number one. He says, we produce and produce until there's simply no one left to purchase our goods. Again, it doesn't bother to ask, why would someone do this, right? Why would somebody do this?
Right.
Then he says, the cycle is still playing out before our eyes. Broadly speaking, it's what made the housing market crash in 2008. Decades of deepening inequality reduced incomes, which led more and more Americans to take on debt. When there were no subprime borrowers left to scheme, the whole facade fell apart just as Marx knew it would. Now, there's many things to say about that, but let me just introduce one quick thing before I turn it over to you. The whole thing we see from Gary North quite a bit about the Pareto split, where he says that basically all societies forever, everywhere in the world, makes no difference. There's always a 20-80 split, that the top 20% have 80%
right.
of the wealth. And then
right.
when you keep calculating, well, 20% of the 20% will have, and it just keeps going on, that in fact the so-called distribution of income we have now more or less conforms to that. So it's not like this is some brand new phenomenon that capitalism brought about. This has existed forever, and so because it has existed forever, it can't possibly be the explanatory factor behind one event in 2008. But what else do you have to say about this?
Oh, I agree with you completely. And as you well know, Tom, having written a book on the Great Recession and the crash of 2008 and the subsequent recession, I mean, this isn't any kind of analysis. This doesn't fit in any way with what we know of the housing market, what went on in the last, you know, in the 5 to 10 years prior to 2008. I mean, there certainly was no increase in mortgage debt corresponding with, quote, decades of deepening inequality. Subprime borrowers were not generally low-income individuals who were, you know, suffering from decades of inequality. The malinvestment in the housing stock that, as Austrians understand, led to the crash and the subsequent recession and so forth doesn't have anything to do with the kind of factors that are described in this quote. I mean, of course, you notice that the author doesn't stop to ask, well, where were the indebted borrowers getting these loans?
Ding, ding, ding. That's right.
Where was the money coming from? There's, of course, no Alan Greenspan or Ben Bernanke in this story. There's nothing about the government, you know, regulations on housing, on borrowing, and so forth. I mean, again, this is just sort of, it's almost just inventing a sentence to try to link some idea in Marx to some very, very generic notion of a housing problem. It's as if the author said, okay, housing debt, I got to work that in somehow. I know that had something to do with the current problem. What did Marx say that could be connected to housing and debt? You know, without actually paying any attention to what, you know, what happened in the 2000s. You know, right. There's no understanding of the financial crisis in here or in this analysis at all.
Right, no attempt to understand individual motivations. Why would people have behaved in this reckless, speculative fashion when it came to real estate? Could it have had something to do with moral hazard created by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Could it have to do with moral hazard created by the Greenspan put? Could it be the false assurance created in 2001 when Greenspan just kept lowering interest rates that housing prices never fall? Like, that didn't just occur. That was caused by government or government-created agencies.
Yeah, as you point out, I mean, you have to be able to – your explanation has to fit the sequence of events in time. And this whole article is riddled with these sort of fallacies where – you just sort of pick some general idea of Marx and imply that it explains something that's going on in the present without considering the timing whatsoever. I think it was Larry White who first said, or from whom I got the great quote, that blaming the financial crisis on greed is like blaming a plane crash on gravity. In other words, you know, if people were greedy, if capitalists were greedy, you know, in 2006 and 2007, they were greedy before and they're greedy now. I mean, that doesn't just invoking greed. It's a bit like invoking, you know, overproduction or invoking inequality as an explanation for some concrete historical event. It's just made up.
Yeah, and there have been there have been societies with vastly greater inequality where this hasn't happened. There have been, and in fact, on the eve of the Great Depression, there was not an increase in inequality going on. There was actually an increase in the share of incomes going to wages and salaries, and a relative fall in incomes going to interest and entrepreneurial income, etc. Now, the second point is, he says, the iPhone 5S, parentheses, imaginary appetite. So this is a very John Kenneth Galbraithian kind of criticism.
Exactly. I was thinking of Galbraith precisely
exactly.
As I read this paragraph.
So here's what he says. He says, Marx warned that capitalism's tendency to concentrate high value on essentially arbitrary products would over time lead to what he called, quote, a contriving and ever-calculating subservience to inhuman, sophisticated, unnatural, and imaginary appetites, unquote. He says, it's a harsh but accurate way of describing contemporary America, where we enjoy incredible luxury. But wait a minute, I thought we were all immiserated, right? We had all – didn't he just tell us that we've had inequality? But he says we enjoy incredible luxury, and yet – are driven by a constant need for more and more stuff to buy. He says, consider the iPhone 5S you may own. Is it really that much better than the iPhone 5 you had last year or the iPhone 4S a year before that? Is it a real need or an invented one, et cetera? So this is, you know, he says, we destroy perfectly good products for no reason. What do you say to that? I mean, why do I need an iPhone 5S when I got a perfectly good iPhone 5, Peter Klein?
You know, there's a stereotype of Marxists as being sort of these grim and humorless types, you know, who dress poorly and don't laugh at jokes and have unkempt hair and so forth. And I guess it's probably a good caricature because Marxism is infused with this very sort of patronizing attitude towards ordinary people. I mean, Marx despised ordinary people. Contemporary Marxists have nothing but contempt for, you know, the masses, because the masses like to consume, and they like to consume all kinds of things that sophisticated, you know, Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Berkeley, California Marxists would consider inappropriate. I remember a professor I once had, who was not exactly a Marxist but was sort of sympathetic to Marx, complaining to me about precisely this point, that people spend their money on the dumbest things, you know, crass consumerism. People should be listening to classical music rather than Miley Cyrus, which, of course, I agree with that. You know, they shouldn't be going to silly movies and so forth. They shouldn't be wearing dumb clothes. Well, gosh, I mean, you and I might agree with, we might share many aesthetic preferences with some of these, you know, lefty types, but that has absolutely nothing to do with what rules we think should apply to a market system. Now, Marx was famous for embracing the labor theory of value, so Marx completely rejects the rejects what we would now describe as the Austrian notion that value is subjective, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, that it's impossible for us as outside observers to say which of a consumer's desires, wants, or needs are legitimate, which are illegitimate. But this is the mentality, again, the patronizing attitude that characterizes central planners, right? That Marx and the Marxists want to say what human needs are legitimate and what needs are illegitimate, and they dislike a system in which ordinary people are free to spend their hard-earned income the way, you know, on what they want. And if people think an iPhone 5 is better than an iPhone 4, there's certainly no scientific principle that would allow us to say, well, no, no, but Tom, you would really be better off if you had spent that money on, you know, a new suit or on a pair of shoes or on a trip to the, you know, to the Grand Canyon or whatever. There's no scientific principle by which one can determine which individual wants or needs are sort of, you know, more legitimate than others.
Well, and of course, and with Galbraith, there is the implication that human beings are really like zombies who are just waiting to be manipulated by the next advertising campaign that will elicit from them the desire to go buy a product they wouldn't have cared about or known about or felt the need for if it hadn't been for this advertising campaign manipulating them. But as Rothbard pointed out in his critique of Galbraith, if that were true, then we wouldn't have business firms spending as much as they do on marketing research to figure out what consumers want. If all you need to do is make a slick advertisement and people will just automatically buy whatever you contrive or whatever you subliminally indicate they need to buy, they wouldn't. They would be a lot happier they didn't have to spend this money figuring out what the heck these inscrutable consumers want.
Yeah, and why would any firms ever go bankrupt, right? They can just persuade people to buy whatever sort of crap they're producing.
Especially today, also, with YouTube, just make a free ad, you know, and everybody will go buy your product.
I mean, speaking of Galbraith, Rothbard also pointed out, you know, that Galbraith's view that, you know, all phones are basically the same and, you know, all automobiles are basically the same. People just think they're different because they're tricked by clever advertising is actually the reverse of the truth, right? To people who don't know anything about cars and don't care about cars, well, a car is just basic transportation. It's four wheels and a steering wheel, and you don't really distinguish one from another. But if you're a car enthusiast, if you're a car buff, if you're a car expert and you really study carefully automobiles and the automobile industry and you race cars or you show cars or whatever, then you're very, you know, carefully attuned to subtle differences among you know, different products within a category. In other words, the more you know about something, the more you realize how different members of the category are. The less you know about it, you know, you think it's all just sort of the same. So it's not that advertising convinces you that there are differences, you know, makes you believe in differences that really aren't there. The more you know about the product, the more attuned to the actual differences you are.
You know, Peter, we've gotten through two out of the five objections or five predictions that Marx allegedly would have made about or made about 2014. And I really do want to hit the other three because it gets juicier as we go along. So would you be willing – this is the first time in the history of the Tom Wood Show I've ever said these words. Would you be willing to come back on the show tomorrow and keep on talking with me?
You know, Tom, I never turned down an opportunity to talk even more, so of course I'd be delighted to do that.
Yeah, it was a trick question, Peter. I knew that about you already. All right, everybody, that's Peter Klein. He is gracious enough to join us again tomorrow as we continue tackling this piece. Not that the piece is so great that it requires two shows, but we're learning a lot as we go through this piece. That's the point. And I thought it would be fun to keep the conversation going with one more program.